Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. My name is Dale Driver and today I'm joined by Matt Purser.
Hello.
Hello. You all right, Matt?
I'm good, thank you, Dale. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. Jesse, you're also here. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Dale. I feel nervous.
Why?
I don't know. It's like a big setup. I'm here. It's all good.
But how are you doing is the big sell. Is that not a question that you deal with every day?
Not really.
Okay, cool. Okay, that's good to know. What have we got today? So, obviously, me and Jesse are on the podcast. So what does that mean? We're talking about Resident Evil, obviously.
What a surprise.
Yeah. But obviously, the big talking point is that Resident Evil 4 is out today. I mean, was it yesterday?
Today. But yesterday, yeah. If you're in New Zealand, who live in the future.
Yes, but we've been very fortunate to have had the game for a little bit, and we've got to spend lots of time with it. So we're going to be chatting about that. But also, coming up on the podcast, we're going to talk... Matt's played Redfall, and you've written a preview about Redfall. We're going to talk about that. And also The Mysterious Everywhere, which... I'm sure he's going to provoke a conversation or two. And then we decided this week, we had so much good feedback this week that we're going to do a double dose of feedback as well. So we'll get to that later in the show. But first, Resident Evil 4. Now, I've finished it twice. Jesse, how many times have you finished it?
I've finished it 6 times.
What the fuck, Jesse?
Is that actually true?
Yeah.
Are you joking?
I'm not joking.
Oh my God. I knew you'd done it like on professional mode really fast.
Yeah.
But 6 times.
It's a good game, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, where do we start like with Resident Evil? Like, Matt, what's your burning questions?
My big burning... So obviously I know, like, I have played Resident Evil 4. It was the first Resident Evil I ever played. I've actually only ever played the Wii version. That was my
good
introduction
version
to it. Yeah,
it's one
yeah.
of the best versions, to be fair. Mm.
Mm-hmm. But kind of like as the series is ticks on, I'm ultimately currently at the point where I think Resi 2 Remake is my favourite of the Resi mm-hmm. games.
Mm.
And obviously this is in the lineage of that, of what 2 started, right, as a remake structure. What is it that's been bought from their learnings of Resi 2 that's made Resi 4, I'm guessing, better since we gave it a 10?
Yeah. I mean, I'd start off by saying, even though I think this game is like, is phenomenal, like it's building on top of a phenomenal game to begin with,
yeah,
and it's only improving across the board, I still do think I'm like you, where I think Resident Evil 2 is probably still my mm-hmm. preferred game, and I think that's more just about style and tone and location and
yeah I
like
love
that,
that structure. I've just finished replaying Resi 2 again, and I still can't get enough of that just immersing yourself in that police station,
yeah,
and
yeah.
learning it and figuring out all the shortcuts and all the secrets. It's yet to be beat, really, in my eyes.
I mean, ultimately, I know that I'm mostly a fan of evil residences. Right? so the Haunted Mansion, the police station, mm-hmm. and then even like with Resident Evil 7, the Baker House and stuff like that. That's my favourite sort of set. However, Resident Evil 4 is like, scope-wise, is way beyond what the other games did. It was originally, and it is now as well. It still maintains, you know, it will take you about 15 hours mm-hmm. on your first playthrough to finish this game. It is a very large game. And what I'd say, what they've done in terms of Resident Evil 2, what they've learned from that is definitely being extremely faithful to the source material, but also making changes where in 2023, those changes feel like they need to be made.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Resident Evil 3 was a big step back.
Yeah.
It definitely felt rushed because the success of Resident Evil 2 when they just need to turn 3 around.
Yeah.
However, there's huge sections of the game from the original that they cut out in the Resident Evil 3 remake. And yes, some of those sections weren't the best, but I feel like they could have rejigged them and remixed them like what they've done in 2. They probably did it more in 2, but in 4, they've definitely done that as well.
Yeah.
Cool.
So we've actually got a video going out this weekend, which is about some of the biggest story differences. And ultimately, the story is the same, but the journey is slightly different, how you get there.
Yeah, I mean, that's your column, Matt, was actually sort of stuck in my head as I was playing through it, because you obviously did a column about like video game remakes
mm-hmm.
and ultimately like what they should really offer an experience. And as I was playing through Resident Evil 4 Remake, you know, it's way more than just a HD clone. We've been seeing that version of Resident Evil 4 re-released for years now.
Over and over and over again, every at platform. This point. Yeah.
And, that's, and it sort of makes people forget that this is a game from 2005. It was released on the GameCube. It's ancient at this point. And if you break down Resident Evil 4's highlights, you know, you've got the village you blast through, you've got the church you save Ashley in, you've got the lake, the castle, and the island, and you visit all of those places in the remake, of course, but it's reimagined and it's remixed in a way that, for me, always kept me on my toes and just sort of had me smiling all the way throughout.
I don't think it's ever, like, remixed beyond recognition as well.
Yeah.
It's always treading that fine line between, oh, this feels familiar, or this, like, oh, I remember this room, but then what's going to happen outside of this room, or the next step? Oh, that's not how exactly it went last time. Like, oh, it's like, I would dare to say this one is like the perfect balance of that. Whereas I feel like Dead Space was close, but it was maybe almost too slavishly like faithful.
Yeah.
This one is definitely like pushes it just a little bit more, but without insulting the original and what people love about it.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that comes to mind with this is the idea of, I think when you're doing a remake, you need to kind of like recontextualize it through who are the current like directors of the project. That's recontextualized by what does the game need to be today, right?
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I've watched very little of this just because I knew I was always going to play it. I'll play it today on release date. But I know that, for example, the Krauser boss fight is much more of an actual boss fight these days.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that is cool about that is when Resident Evil 4 originally came out, QTEs were like starting to become flavor of the year, right? Like everybody was doing QTEs, so you could have these super cool boss battles that look cinematic that you sort of had a hand in but didn't really have a hand in.
Yeah.
And the fact that they've made that an actual boss fight now, I think, is a demonstration of, we've got the tech now and the audience demand is that you can play the game rather than watch the game. And I think that's what I'm looking for in something like this.
That's what I was worried about before, like, because I remember seeing that in a trailer and, you know, I was sort of thinking to myself, how can you really adapt? Like, one of the coolest or best examples of a QTE cutscene of near enough that entire era when, you know, Krauser and Leon are having that knife fight. And like you said, you make it an actual knife fight in the remake that you can play through. And as soon as that wrapped up for me, I was like, shit, that controlled really well. In my head, I was like, can we actually be in a place where we can make the remake live up to how cool that cutscene was? And I feel like it absolutely delivers for me.
I think it's a very, that particular fight scene is very clever in terms of when you actually played it through a couple of times and you realize you can see the cracks and you can see, like, it is kind of just like little mini cutscenes strung together.
Yeah.
But it definitely, but it does, the presentation of it feels you so much more active instead of I'm just hitting the Y button or whatever it was in the original game, like the triggers or something. It's like now you're actually, you are using the knife techniques that you've been using this entire game. And they in turn trigger moments.
Exactly. It puts forth that illusion really well where Leon and Krauser sort of like both slowly fighting for space. Like you'll go in for a swipe, he'll, you know, dodge it or parry it, and then he'll back away only to come back charging. And if you miss that parry, then you might get locked up into like a little button mashing minigame. And then and then you get some of that like original Resident Evil 4 dialogue in those sections. So it's all incorporated just really well.
I think a great like one moment that is very early in the game, so it's not really a spoiler. And I think it's kind of illustrates like where they're at now is, in the original game, you'd have that sequence where the giant boulder is pushed to you and you've just got to hammer the buttons to run away from the boulder. And now there's an homage to that sequence. There's a moment that like makes you think, like lures you in, you think, oh, this is that going to be that? And then it's just slightly different. But it relies on how you deal with it is more modern techniques. You know?
Yeah.
It's people trying to cause this thing. I'm trying not to, but cause a situation. And then you have to use your brain to solve. It's a puzzle. No, it's not even a puzzle. It's just walking around. But
see, like it doesn't feel like a moment from 2005. It's something that you would expect in a modern Resident Evil.
It feels like
It's
the idea of what happened in the original, and then, but now it feels like a modern implementation of it.
Yeah.
And the game is full of that, really. And I'm also quite surprised, like pleasantly surprised, how much of the weirdness and the campiness they've kept in as well, because it could have been so easy to strip all that back and say that was campy 2005. We want it to be gritty and serious. But Leon is still there. He's still doing like German suplexes to people and like roundhousing them in the face. He's Salazar is still, you know, a small man who's very crazy and
terrifying
weird
looking and stuff.
Some of the, like, he's still, and it's well documented now, he still says the line about everyone going to bingo.
Yeah.
Like, they've taken some things out, because some things go, they've definitely taken, like, me and Jesse were joking about it yesterday, they've toned down the horniness of everyone a little bit in the game. Because there was a lot of that going on in the original.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, it's consistently people being distracted by the mission because they wanted to try a little pickup line. You know?
But that's the thing, like, even when it comes to the characters themselves, like, primarily Leon and Ashley, I think they're probably the most human characterizations we've seen from protagonists in a Resident Evil game. Like you know, Dale said, like, don't get us wrong, there's still like plenty of dumb lines throughout the game, but you see an actual relationship grow with Leon and Ashley throughout the game that you didn't really get in the original. That's only ever really left for cutscenes, and they're you know, quite spare. But at first in the remake, you see that Ashley is, you know, apprehensive and scared about a lot of things. But then outside of the cutscenes, you get moments when you're interacting, you know, and it can be dependent on your actions. If you pick something up, Ashley might say something. If you get hurt and heal yourself, Ashley will ask you if you're okay now and stuff. And it's those small little things that sort of build up their relationship compared to how you see in the original game where, yeah, everyone's just horny by the end of the game.
Well, it's also in the original, Ashley is just completely complicit at all times, right? Leon, like, as soon as Leon's there, she's
like, get in the bin. And she's like, okay, and then hides.
He's like, I'm your knight in shining armor, do exactly what I say. And she's complicit the whole way through. And she's like, you know, presented as like worshiping him by the end of it. And, you know, you can understand that a little bit because he's her savior. But in this one, there's definitely, they have to build that relationship. She is very hesitant of him at first.
Mm.
And a great tiny example, like, don't want to go too much into spoilers, but a great time example is the first time now that you ask her to hide in something. Her response, she literally just goes, what? Like, what are you asking me to do here? This is weird.
Mm-hmm.
But then by the end of it, you know, she starts to warm to him and they develop a relationship. And I think across the board, the game is full of that. Krauser and Leon's relationship is developed this time as well. It's not, like, I remember playing the original in 2005 and once I finished the Salazar Castle part, I thought that was going to be the end of the game. Because, I mean, looking back at hindsight now, I shouldn't have been so stupid because Sadler is peppered in throughout the first half of it.
Yeah.
But Krauser doesn't show up until about the 10th hour of that game. Like, he's just not in the game at all. And then all of a sudden he's like, remember when we used to be buddies back in the army? And I was like, who are you? What's going on?
You thought I died in that crash. And I was like, what?
Yeah, like the writing, it, like although it's a, you know, an iconic game and story, like there was definitely room for improvement. I feel like across the board they've spotted every element where they can improve this game and they've achieved it.
Absolutely. There's even just like one tiny moment, because for me Resident Evil has never been a scary experience and stuff, even if whether you play it in VR and stuff, it's always just been a fun action horror inspired experience for me. But there was one moment in the remake where, and it's the Regenerator's first appearance. Everyone sort of remembers it in the original, where you can hear them sort of breathing in the distance in the lab, and it's like quite a creepy moment. But in the remake, it just reminded me of, and I won't go into too much detail, but it reminded me of when I played Amnesia for the first time as a kid when I was like 13 years old. And it's hearing that monster first, not being able to see it, and then that the fear of the unknown, and you sort of like get like a little twist in your stomach. And I had that for just a few brief moments when I was playing the remake, and it felt great. It was like a genuine surprise, like, oh, Resident Evil can be creepy still at times.
Yeah.
And they nailed that in the remake.
That's my favorite Resident Evil. And 4 is definitely, like, it has the spirit of the original.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, if they remake 5, I imagine, you know, they might have to make some bigger decisions, I guess, for that. But 4, like, they knew they were working with a masterpiece to begin with.
Absolutely. Right?
So it's like, how do we make one of the greatest games of all time just that little bit better?
And, yeah.
I feel like I could talk about this game for hours, but also feel like it would just be recounting some of our favorite moments, the scenes and stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously people haven't played the game yet. They're playing it today, hopefully, and, you know, over the weekend. So maybe it'd be good to check back in when other people have played it. Matt, when you've played it, when Cardi's played it, whoever, and just see what everyone else thinks. But yeah, Resident Evil, pretty good.
It's a very final question. How are the headshots? Because I love the ones in two, like the proper head split, like shotgun blasts.
So I was under the impression when I played the demo originally that they didn't have like the, I can't remember what they called their Gore-Tech, but you know, their flesh peeling-y system thing. And they definitely didn't have it in three. But I think it is there, just in a different form. A good example is if someone, a Ganado, gets trapped in a bear trap, which they can get trapped in their own bear traps this time. It's really stupid, but it's funny. Like, for example, if you boot them out of it, like, their leg will rip off and, like, stay in the trap and stuff. Like, you, if you're firing the shotgun around, like especially the striker, like, quite clumsily, you'll see, like, bits of arms dropping off, and you'll see, like, all the sort of the tentacle sort of things of the Las Plagas, like, hanging out. There was definitely gore like that. I don't see, you don't see like face, you see a head explode, obviously. Like, but yeah, I guess they're pretty satisfying.
Yeah, nice.
Like, combat is so fast and there's so many enemies to deal with all the time that you don't often take time to get around and smell the roses.
Just, you know, when you blow up an enemy, just look, like Dale said, at the details of the plugger sort of just like crawling around their bodies and trying to reach out, because it is grim, but it's just really impressive.
But there's also, like, I still haven't quite worked out, I don't even know if I ever worked out this in the original, the ones that have the Plagas things that will come out of their heads and they're all, like, flying all over the place. Is, like, is there a system where you should acknowledge that these ones don't, you don't want to do a headshot because it would explode, or do they always explode no matter what?
I think the head would, like, either, it depends obviously how far you're into the game, because it's just random chance whether...
Yeah, Ganado. That's the thing. I wasn't sure if there was a tell and like, oh, you don't want to do a headshot on these ones because it will make it worse. Like kind of like the crimson head things, you know, like, and they have a version of that in this where some of them will go down, you see them convulsing on the floor and you can use a knife attack to make sure they don't become something more. But yeah, it's very satisfying, isn't it? Like, I was just playing through bits for capture for a video that I've made that's gone live today about all the cool little details in it. And I had so much fun also putting it down to the easiest mode and just running around and just like dominating everybody and seeing like sort of what variations you can do.
Yeah, like shooting a stick of dynamite that's in someone's hand and just seeing like the Spanish granny explode is hilarious.
It's always very satisfying. Yeah, there's definitely lots of ways you can take people out. Like you can weaponize cows in this game. Like if you pop a bullet in a cow, it'll go mental and run around on face. But if there's loads of enemies in front of you, it'll take all the enemies out for you. It will take you out if it gets to you.
Yeah.
but there's lots of like creative way. There's lots of like hanging lamps and things like that.
Yeah.
Like
the original I will say though, before we move on, whatever you do, don't play this game on hardcore for your first playthrough. The game will suggest that if you're a fan of Resident Evil 4, don't do it. The game is difficult now.
So even though I played on standard my first time around, and there's several sections where, it took like, you know, three or four goes to get through. There's, people remember on the original, there's a storm of a villa when you're in there with Luis and you've just got waves coming at you. That took me quite a few goes because I did not, I went into that with a lack of ammo because I didn't know it was coming up. And I had to be really strategic about it to get through it in the end. It's, I would say definitely play on standard you first go around, and then there's hardcore and there's professional afterwards if you really want to test yourself. And it's a good fun time.
Mercenaries
coming soon as well.
Yeah, April 7th, which is a like pretty quick turnaround. Like you can play through the campaign, like
almost like they had it ready.
I know
already. Yeah, and they've just held it back for another release. You know?
It's a nice little drop. I'm happy.
Okay. So Matt, let's move on. You've played Redfall, and we have not. So tell us all about it.
So Redfall is, as I imagine most people now know from the marketing, because it's been delayed a few times and we've had it in pretty much every Xbox showcase, I think.
Yeah.
It's a four-player, I think it's four-player, co-op. Yeah. Open world game, very much kind of like in the vein of like maybe a Borderlands meets Far Cry, but rather than shooting weird fucking monsters like you would in a Borderlands or people in a Far Cry, your main antagonist in this are vampires. So it's set in the town of Redfall, which is like an island off Massachusetts. It's got very kind of like Stephen King vibes in the, you know, like all of Stephen King's stuff is, it's mostly set in Maine, isn't it, Stephen King stuff, but it's got that kind of East Coast, slightly spooky, like all of the houses like kind of look a little bit like they could all be haunted.
Yeah,
it's that kind of vibe, but it's an open world game. You play as there's four different characters to choose from, each with very, very different abilities. And it's made by Arkane. So these are the guys that made Dishonored, that made Prey. It's not the Deathloop team. It's the team from Austin rather than Lyon in France. And obviously, I'm a big Arcane fan, so I was very excited to play this. And what I will say initially is this is a lot more conventional than their other games. I've not been as kind of like blown away by it as I have. Like, I really obviously love Deathloop and I love Dishonored. Mm. But what I would say is I still think this was really good. And it is kind of, I've got a bit bored of Far Cry, basically. Kind of the last couple haven't really done it for me. And Borderlands never really does it for me because I don't like the humor of Borderlands. This feels like it's in a sweet spot of, it's that kind of game. Like, I do like open world games. I like games that, you know, I can play with friends as well. I like games with weird sort of abilities. It's got like that. It's got a little bit of that kind of like the out of the box thinking that Arcane has, but it is definitely a very recognizable open world with safe houses, with kind of like open world activities to go and do, and sort of like taking back areas from the villains. It's a very conventional shooter in that way. The loot is tier graded, like you're going to get like gold guns and blue guns and green guns. It's got a lot of very recognizable things, which is not what I expect from Arcane. I expect Arcane's games to be very bizarre and not like what I've played in other things. So it is, like, as I say, it means that kind of like what I've done is I've played a game that is quite similar to a lot of other games that I've played before, which means that I'm not instantly like, holy crap, this is like something really special. But I do think that it is pulling in ways that might make me a lot more interested in open world shooters again. Part of that is just, it's got vampires in it, and very good vampires. They've got kind of like a real good creep vibe to them. They kind of like hang in the air quite ethereally, like very, very strange. They're quite unnerving when you see them. But the actual way that you have to kill them is, so you've got a massive variety of like very standard guns. You've got shotguns, pistols, all of those kind of things that you would expect in a Far Cry game to enable different situations. You know, are you close? Are you far? Do you want to use a sniper rifle? Do you want to use a silence gun or whatever? But none of those bullets are ever going to kill a vampire, because vampires obviously are immortal and there are laws to how you take down vampires, and this game has that. So once you've like decimated their health bar, basically, they just kind of hang in the air and all of their chest starts to kind of like unfurl and peel back and sort of like glow. And then quite a lot of your guns have a bayonet that's a stake on the end. Of course. And you run over and you slam it into them and you get like a really super cool animation where like all of their flesh just ignites and burns away and leaves their skeleton behind. So it's got, I wouldn't say it's a gory game by any means, but it is very kind of theatrical when it comes to taking out vampires. And then if you don't have a stake, because I did notice, like, you don't have to have a stake, and it's not like your character is equipped with like stakes instead of like a knife.
Yeah.
So if you decided for whatever mad reason that you haven't got a gun that has a stake attached to it, there are other ways. Like, you can set the bodies on fire. So if you've got a flare gun, or if there's like an explosive barrel nearby, or you can blow up a car. And then you can also use electricity, because obviously electricity generates heat and that will blow them up. So there's a lot of that, like, oh, there's a pile of kind of like electrical equipment over here. If I can create some sort of explosion around them, they'll do. So there's a lot of that kind of, I wouldn't say it's a like a full environmental destruction sort of thing. It is very much like, I can see pre-planned bits that they've dropped into this environment that we know you're going to have a fight here, so therefore we've given you a few tools around.
Yeah.
About garlic bombs? What's the other one?
Silver.
About crosses, is there any religious aspect?
I have not seen it. So there's no religious aspects because they're not demonic in nature. This is very much a 21st century reimagining of vampires in that basically... They're the 1%, so they are people that desperately want to be immortal and have got the money to pay to be immortal.
That's cool.
And they've basically, there's an umbrella-like pharmaceutical company that have developed vampirism, basically, to allow people to live forever.
So they're like bioorganic designed
millionaires.
Sort of.
And they're like, you can have immortal life, you just, unfortunately, you have to like suck
blood. For the rest of your life. And it's quite funny, what's happened is kind of like the area of Redfall, and from what I understand, kind of like, so the map does seem smaller than a lot of open world games, which for me is actually a pro.
Sounds like a good thing.
I've got fed up of like, what, like Far Cry's constant attempt to, our map is bigger than it was last time. And it's like, your map's bigger than it was last time, and I spend so much time just walking through fields.
Yeah.
This feels much more kind of smaller and contained. And the bit that I was in, I think, is its equivalent of, I guess, like Zelda's like Great Plateau style thing. Like, it was the opening. And like, you could get from north to south in it in about 5 minutes. Like, it is like, they're just compact streets.
I'm into that.
But each area of the world is going to have like a different vampire god that's in charge of it. So the stuff that I was doing was this guy called the Hollow Man, which I learned a little bit about it, but obviously they were very much like, we're only going to give you so much story in a 90-minute demo. And that was, I had to go to his house to try and find out. Clearly, like, the item that I got at the end of that quest is an item that I'll be able to use to weaken him so that he's not godlike anymore and give me an opportunity to kill him. And that mission was, that was kind of like, I'd say, a relatively standard kind of infiltration house clearing mission in that he got this massive mansion, and obviously I needed to find a secret inside. But the mansion had got like these types of what I've dubbed kind of like CCTV vampires that are on the top that have, like, you can see like the laser line coming out of their eyes, and they're scanning for kind of people that are coming in. And then they've got kind of like more, I guess what you call like attack dog style vampires that are hanging around. And they've got groups of cultists with them, because there's a load of humans that, as we see on social media, there are a lot of people that like to suck up to our big billionaires, don't they?
Yeah.
And it's basically, they've just like converted half the island to being people that are obsessed with vampires and want to serve them.
Right.
So those guys are very much your standard. You know, you see a group of them and you're like, oh, I'm going to create a noise over here and get like two of them to leave the pack.
Yeah.
And then I can jump down and I can sort of knock them out from behind and then just hurl a like a grenade or whatever over the fence and get rid of the other two.
How much of this can be, because like the way I like to play Dishonored would be, you know, like an entire stealth run, but with Deathloop I went like all guns in blazing and stuff. So like, how much of this can you try and maintain a certain level of stealth all throughout, or is it always just going to be a mix just based on what you experienced?
So what I would say is, like, this is definitely a shooter. Like, it's not Dishonored. Dishonored is a stealth game. It was like their modern 21st century like version of what Thief used to be. This is clearly them, like, the two touch points they said that they were using as influences is their other games, obviously, but also Far Cry 2 and Stalker, which are the two weirdest kind of options you could have for. They were open world games that were doing things interesting in open worlds before everybody decided that actually Far Cry 3 was the template for literally every one of these shooters ever going. Which I've only seen like small glimmers of what that will be, but my hope is that that means it's a bit more interesting. But in regards to how you approach stealth or whatever, I think there's, to send people to another website, if you go to Xbox Wire, previous podcast host and friend of the podcast, Joe Screbbles, because he works at Xbox, he got to play the demo through twice, and he's played it with two different characters. And I think that is where your kind of more arcane-y, what sort of playstyle do I want? It's not, do I just go in stealth or do I go in loud? It's choose a character that supports the playstyle you want. So there is a guy, and I can't remember what his name is, but one of the characters is like ex-special forces. His special ability is he can go invisible. He's got like a raven that he can send into areas to scout for him. And he's got like an ability where he can highlight like 10 enemies on the map and just take them out instantly, like bang, 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 bang.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's
Jacob
clearly...
Boyer, is it?
Pardon?
Jacob Boyer?
Yes, that's the guy.
Yeah.
So he's clearly your stealth agent. Like, he's got, you know, like a sniper rifle and a invisibility cloak that's designed for that. Whereas if you want to be maybe a little bit more louder and chaotic, there's a girl called Remy, and she's kind of like a demolition and robotics expert. So she's got like a little robot that you can send in that I think can like electrocute enemies. And then you can go in with a C4 charge and you can slap that on things and blow people up. You can also upgrade the C4 so you can use it as like a bouncing bomb. So you can throw it down, explode it, and you can ride the explosion like up over other enemies and then drop down and shoot them from behind and stuff. So there's definitely that mix. I played as a guy called Davinder, who is basically British Buffy. Like, he is, he's built his entire kind of like, he's got like a YouTube channel, he's an aspiring kind of documentary kind of maker, but his documentaries are if Attenborough was interested in fucking weird things.
So is he the one that was advertised as the zoologist?
Yeah, he's the cryptozoologist. Yeah.
Oh, God.
So he is obviously... It's interesting because it is a game where the characters speak to themselves. It's got a little bit of that. And I think they speak to each other if you play in co-op. But who you play as will dictate kind of like almost how the story is delivered to you, because Devinder is obviously obsessed with vampires, so he's coming up with all the names for the vampires as you meet them and stuff yeah. like that. So you're getting, whereas I imagine if you play someone like Jacob, you're getting a much more militarized kind of version of how like he experiences the story.
Yeah.
But Devinder's kit is much more kind of like DIY kill vampires. So he's got this this kind of lance that you throw that when it lands, it just spits out a load of electricity. So very good for stunning people and like basically deleting vampires out of existence. his ultimate is something called the black light, which is basically a camera tripod with a shitload of UV lights on the top. And when vampires get caught in that, it turns them to stone. So you just run up to them and hit them a few times and they collapse into pieces.
It's like a blade weapon.
Yeah. And then he's got, which I really liked, he's got a translocator. So it's like a frisbee that you chuck and then you just appear wherever the frisbee lands. Which that's for me, really as cool. someone that's played shitloads of Dishonored, was very much like,
that's what I was thinking.
Oh, I've got here and I can see that window on the third floor is open. Rather than me fighting my way through this place, I'm just going to throw it up through there and I'm going to get in and I'm going to sneak around a bit.
I've got a question in terms of these abilities. So obviously you didn't get to play in co-op, but did you get the implication that like the people are going to have complementary abilities in co-op?
Yeah, so I spoke to Harvey Smith, who's the director. So him and Ricardo Bear, who are the two directors on the project, I spoke to them like last year about that. And the one thing they did say they wanted to do is they didn't want to do something like It Takes Two, where one person has an ability and it can only work if there's another person there, because they're like, that completely invalidates the playstyle of someone that only wants to play it on their own. But what there is abilities that complement each other. I can't tell you what those are because I didn't get to use that. But certainly when we had like, we were given like a little bit of a presentation before we got to play the demo, and Harvey Smith was like, we've designed the characters to be able to like, you will work out that, oh, this ability is great on its own, but it actually works way more to a higher potential when another person's doing something else at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, like, this game, to me, sounds great in co-op. I don't know if it's a single-player game I'm necessarily that interested in, but it sounds like it could be a lot of fun. Like, yeah, working out, though, like, seeing what the characters have and what sort of variety they have, and, yeah, putting them to use together and working out as a team.
Yeah. I certainly liked it, playing it on my own. I will play it co-op almost certainly, like, as primarily. Like, my partner's definitely into the idea of it as well. And I think it's a game that is clearly built, whilst it supports stealth, it feels like it's the sort of way that it supports it in. Wouldn't it be great if two of you could come from either side of this area and work it out together rather than just playing it on your own? I don't think it's necessarily going to be detrimental if you don't want to play it with anyone, but I think its highest potential is probably there if you are playing it with other folks.
Nice. I'm very looking forward to it.
But yeah, also you get a stake launcher in it, which was my favorite weapon. And when you fire that into them, they just immediately explode.
Oh, I was hoping it would like send them backwards into the wall and then they would like sort of melt around it.
No, it's very much, it's the only one hit kill weapon for a vampire basically. And you get like a UV gun, which you can kind of fire the beam into it and they'll gradually turn to stone.
Nice. I do want more vampires in games, and this is like perfect timing.
Yeah.
So I'm happy.
I suppose it all takes place at night, right?
No, there is a day-night cycle, but they have blotted out the sun. So when it's in the day, it's not full daylight.
But that's like a fucking Mr. Burns sort of scenario going on there.
Part of me would actually be interested in the sort of I Am Legend sort of scenario where it's just like scavenging in the day and then at night it all kicks off.
That's
Dying Light. Sort of
yeah, that's Dying Light, isn't it? Yeah, no, this has got, it's got certainly systemic things where, because each area is owned by a vampire god, if you kill too many of his like powerful, like I guess lieutenants, for a lack of a better word, if you keep killing powerful vampires, they send this guy called the Rook after you. So each time you kill someone, it'll be like the vampire gods are watching and a meter will build up. And then I built the meter up because I was curious to see what happens. And basically an entire like electrical storm kicks off. And this vampire that's built like the Incredible Hulk just like lands in front of you, has a load of backup, and it becomes like a very, very difficult big shootout. Yeah. But I think in that, that kind of that's the distinguishing point, right? It's not like Arkane's other games, because so much of it revolves around full bore combat. Mm. So, you know, to a degree, I think like Arkane almost made a rod for their own back by making so many Dishonored games. You know, they made three of them, maybe four, if you consider the DLC to be an entire game. And they made a name for themselves on were like really fucking good at stealth games. But they're obviously interested in applying their outside the box thinking to other genres. But everybody still comes to them and goes, oh, I'm guessing it's a stealth game. But it's not. This is definitely them playing around with shooters rather than stealth.
I mean, and cynically as well, you can look at it from a financial perspective, like those games didn't exactly set the world on fire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shooters is the maybe, you know, an avenue for them to import their ideas, but to a broader audience.
Mm. Yeah, something that someone will actually bloody play, right?
Yeah. Hopefully. Like, I'm definitely like, I was kind of lukewarm and I thought I'd probably check it out, but you've definitely like, sold me on the idea and I'd be up for playing it as a team, you know, a bunch of us jumping in and seeing what we could come up with.
I'll be the quiet one, as always.
Are you kidding? You're shut when we're playing games. anyway, Matt, you've just had a big, long talky bit and now you've got another bit talky bit coming up, but you've seen something called Everywhere, which... was developed by, is it Leslie Benzies?
The producer of 8 GTA games and like one of the masterminds, I think, behind. He was one of the designers on GTA 5, and I think one of the reasons why it probably is as big as it was. Yeah. Like, he's a talented guy.
So Heritage them.
Yeah.
So yeah, you were invited to check out this new game called Everywhere. Now, I know you're going to have a tough time with this, but tell us what Everywhere is.
Jesus. Right. You can read what it is on the website. It took me a long time to figure out how to explain what it is.
Mm.
So Everywhere, developed by so Leslie Benzies now has a company called Builder Rocket Boy. So it's not made by Rockstar. That's important. And Everywhere is less of a game, more of a platform. Right. And at its heart, it is... The easiest way to describe it is it's like high definition Roblox. Like, it is a game creation tool, but it doesn't stop there. It's more of a platform that includes that game creation tool, a social hub that reminds me a lot of PlayStation Home. That's in like a city. So rather than PlayStation Home being, I guess, more of a plaza, this is a city with different districts. And surrounding that city is an open world made up of four different biomes. And then they're building another AAA, slightly GTA-lookish game that you can only play in Everywhere. And that's called
Mind's Eye. Is
it
using the tools, though?
Yes. So they obviously have like a better version of those tools because, for example, what they showed us of Mind's Eye obviously has motion captured characters in it and stuff, but fundamentally it's built in the tools that you can use in Everywhere.
Doesn't feel like a good idea to release tools and say, here's some amazing tools that you can use, but you'll never do better than this though.
So. Yeah. it is a bit, I don't know. Like, so obviously the tools have been very much designed as, now, I'm going to preface this with, I was at the studio for 5 hours. I didn't once get to play this game. Mm. And for example, of Mind's Eye, I got to see, there was a trailer that was released yesterday, which is about 30 seconds long. I got to see that, plus maybe about another 2 minutes of which it was cutscene, not gameplay. So I can't really tell you a huge amount. And then the rest of it was watching very quick snippets of how the game bit works and how the game creation bit works. So I've still only seen very, very fragmented bits of this. But the game creation tool, it looks like the midway between Roblox and Dreams, in which if Dreams is where like you... Dreams is completely blank canvas, right? In that you go in and you literally have to sculpt the things that you want to begin with. And then you work from there. Whereas Roblox, let's say, is more like a Lego kit in that you're like putting stuff together. Mm. It's kind of like the midway point between there. So you can, it's very much kind of like, here's a menu with loads of things in it. Start dropping them in quite like a level editor from like Halo's level editors, for example.
Yeah.
And you can do all of that. But then there's kind of like, so the one that they showed us was they got like wall pillars that they were building kind of like around the edge of this Colosseum style thing. And they were pre-built in the catalog.
Yeah.
But you can also use kind of like, they wanted to build like a set of pipe work that came out of it. So there was loads of like little kind of like quarter semicircles, and they fitted four of those together to create a cylinder and then extruded it. So you're kind of using some very, very basic shapes to create more interesting shapes, and some is pre-built stuff. And then obviously anything that a player makes can then be turned into what they call a stamp and then put in. So that might be like you created, like, I don't know, a recreation of an item that's in one of your favorite games, or you made something interesting.
I mean, that's Dreams, right?
Yeah. Or you can do like, I built a boss, and I've built, you know, someone else has bought a level and they need a boss for their level, so that they just take that other person's boss and drop it in their level. So it's kind of like, it requires no coding knowledge whatsoever. It is very much that sort of like, I've put an item in here and I want to apply logic to it. If you touch this, it turns this on. Or if the enemy sees this, it does this to you. So it's very kind of like accessible design. The only thing I'd say about it is that we were being shown examples that were obviously being built by the people that have made this tool. I kind of think it looked all a bit boring.
Right.
Like the enemy, like they built this giant robotic scorpion, and it was, I have a bugbear against enemies that just stay off screen and don't move, and that it's just like they reach into the player space.
Yeah.
It's one of those enemies. But I don't think you can necessarily program it with a huge amount of like intelligence. It just very much seemed to be, it swept its claws left and right, and if you got caught in the claws, you got caught in the claws. And then it would tilt its head and breathe fire. And it kind of like it wasn't moving around, it wasn't doing anything particularly interesting. And whilst I understand that kind of like that is probably symbolic of what most people that play this game are going to create, because most people are not going to be like talented game designers, right? They just want to play around. They just want to create a Lego kit that's got things.
Yeah.
I think if you're demoing it to a bunch of press to tell the rest of the world what it's like, you want to demonstrate what the highest level of what someone could make in this.
Yeah.
And if that's what the highest level can make, I kind of think it's just a bit dull. Yeah. And that then applied to what they've made in the game is in terms of like, when I say that there's kind of like an open world that runs around the edge of the kind of city, they didn't really show us anything that could happen in there, but they showed us some examples of the third person shooter combat that they've got and the driving, which seem to be like the two main mechanics of the game. And it just, to me, looks a little bit like, oh, the racing is probably you just press A and go very fast and take some corners. And the shooting was, did a bunch of double jumps and you shot a laser gun at things. And it all felt what I would describe as kind of bread and butter.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure the whole sheen of it, whilst Mind's Eye, which is this AAA game they're making in everywhere, looks like, I mean, the main guy in it is played by the guy that plays the main guy in Mafia 3. And he's recognised with that. It's got that kind of what I would call a Quantic Dream style sheen to the graphics. Yeah. That's what it looks like. The main bit of everywhere, you know, the bit that you're going to be spending most of your time in, the bit where you play kind of like these little mini games they've got, and you play and you create your own games. All of that looks like Fortnite. It just looks like they looked at Fortnite and was like, well, that's the aesthetic that everybody loves. So that's what we're going to use.
And this makes no sense to me. Like, surely with a game creation tool, the idea is to maintain an aesthetic, right? So anytime you see a game developed in Dreams, you can tell by the brushstrokes that this was made in Dreams.
Yeah.
You know, it's consistent vision across the board. Like, what are they really trying to make here? Like, are they trying to make a game creation tool, or are they trying to build a social space where they think, oh, we can build a social space where people can make games to play together? Which I guess what Roblox is.
Yeah, this is the thing is like, I genuinely, after spending 5 hours at the studio, is their ambition to literally do everything, or is their ambition like spread so thinly that there's no focus?
Yeah.
It's like as a social space, is it actually going to be an interesting social space? Like, in the city, there's PvP matches that you can go into, which I guess are kind of like little kind of zones where you do, like, you know, maybe 6v6. And there are races you can do. And I get the impression there's also similar things that you can do out in this kind of open world that rings around the city. But that kind of looks like, well, why would I do that when I can play Fortnite, which has already like a very established good gun feel, has interesting mechanics and stuff like that.
I suppose Fortnite's not a social space, though, is it?
Well, so, but it is a social space now because of the create mode where people have just been making islands and that you can go and hang out in.
Also, and just like a day ago, they announced the Fortnite Creative, like, what, 2.0? Like, Unreal Editor and Fortnite are pretty much just one thing now. So that game's going to last fucking forever. Like, possibilities are near enough endless with new Unreal Engine tech. Yeah. And Fortnite, which is a good shooter.
What you kind of described to me was, at first, I thought it was sounding like The City in Free Guy a little bit.
Right,
maybe
not
even, maybe nowhere near as good as that. But like the idea that people can be social, but there's also fucking mad car chases and things like that going on that people have custom built. Is it that impressive?
Well,
Probably not.
Not from what I can tell is, I think, like, I don't think you're going to have, like, the game bits happening alongside the social bits. I think,
you
like, you're in the city like the plaza from PlayStation Home. And, you know, an impressive thing they showed me is that you can walk up to, like, a video screen that shows a PvP match going on and you'd walk into it. Like, you'd jump into the screen. So there's some presentation things that are interesting, and I think, like, the game bits are more instanced away from the social bits. But the social bits to me just sounded a bit like, right, so you know that Fortnite has got like their creator mode and people have been making loads of like interesting islands that are more for mucking about in than they are for like playing Battle Royale.
Mm.
But also the idea that it's got like an entertainment district. And it's like, okay, well, what's that for? Well, it feels to me it's like, well, Fortnite can do like big concerts and they can do like all of this kind of like Christopher Nolan doing his premieres for his trailers in Fortnite. It feels like it's all built to do stuff that Fortnite has been doing for years, that Roblox have been doing for decades.
Mm.
And it's a bit like, it all feels a bit, I can't necessarily see what the advancement is over those games.
Yeah.
Aside from the fact that this has like this open world, that it's a game creator in a social space that already has like an open world built in it, but they've shown me nothing about that open world and their bespoke game modes that I would want to play over a game that's more dedicated to that. I'd rather go off and play Rainbow Six Siege if I want a shooter. I'd rather play Fortnite if I wanted a colorful battle royale. Like, I'd rather play those games. And so it's a bit like, well, it's everything and almost, is it going to end up being everything and nothing at the same time?
Yeah,
I think it needs a better sense of identity, a better sense of focus.
I mean, what's their audience? What are they going for here? Because I don't think you're going to pull away from Roblox.
No,
because I've played Roblox quite a few times with my nieces and stuff. Like, there is an inherent simplicity and charm to that game that you're never going to be able to achieve with the way this looks, what I can tell, that will never appeal to children, like really young children.
Even on the flip side of that, like, people are developing like near enough, like, pretty good looking, like, first person shooters as well for Roblox these days as well. And even VR titles within Roblox as well. Like, people are going insane in just that game alone.
You also can't compete with, I don't know when Roblox came out, probably about 10 years ago, maybe.
I think the original one, 2006, I think.
Yeah, I was playing it when I was in primary school.
You can't compete with that kind of legacy out of the gate either. And then, like, this is a new studio, it's their first game. What happens if it just doesn't perform for the first year? They're going to abandon it, potentially. Like,
my feeling is that it's almost like maybe the original idea was to position it as, you've done Roblox, you're not at the point where you're going to use Dreams, which is a bit too kind of like blank canvas. You have to come up with everything for Dreams.
Yeah.
Right. And so it feels like it's almost set in the middle there. But that middle was Fortnite creator mode, which was like, you're given just an island in Fortnite. You can do whatever you want with it. So I think that's where, if you're in, like, for lack of a better word, middle school, that's where you're going to go. You're going to graduate from Roblox to Fortnite creator. And now you're going to graduate from that to the new Unreal editor for Fortnite, which gives you Fortnite creative mode, but with even more freedom. Like if you started, you know, if you're in high school or early university and you've started doing 3D modeling, well, now Unreal Editor for Fortnite allows you to put those 3D models you've made into your Fortnite creations. So it's like there's such a clear Roblox Fortnite creator Unreal for Fortnite pathway that I'm now like, well, where does this stand a chance? Like Fortnite's got 500 million users.
It also doesn't have even like what Fortnite has, and even what PlayStation Home had was the licensing aspect of it as well. Like, unless they want to spend a load of money and get licensed involved with it, like that, you know, the big value to PlayStation Home was that it was just like, yeah, I love Gran Turismo. I can go to a place where other people love Gran Turismo and we can talk about it and we can launch a game together. Yeah. And that was 15 years ago, you know, like, and Fortnite obviously is like up to the wazoo, fooled with licenses and new, every time a new film comes out, there's something new comes with it.
Yeah.
Are they going to be able to do that in this game? Like, probably not off the bat.
Like, I don't want to say it's doomed because I've seen all of, like, you know, an hour of it in motion.
Yeah.
But I don't think it looks good.
It paints a picture, doesn't it, of just what's probably going to be an impressive tool set when it comes out. But there's already so many things other people can do. And then this new creative method isn't going to get any traction behind it. It's just going to die.
I think you're bang on the money in that, like, it might be an impressive thing in isolation. Like, I think it will probably be quite fun to put a level together with that tool. Like, there's probably some fun to be had, but it won't come out in isolation. It's going to come out to Roblox, which has dominated children's, like, introduction to games, and Fortnite, which is the biggest thing on the planet and has no sense of stopping.
It's you never know, though. You never know. Like, I remember when Fortnite first came out and it was easily dismissed. You know, like, so you never know. They might build, word of mouth might build, and, you know, they might have some plans at the seed. Like you said, you've only seen a tiny.
And maybe that Mind's Eye game turns out to be absolutely terrific, and that's the pull in, right? Like, they use that to pull people in.
Lincoln Clay is back.
Okay, so we're not going to do a game this week, and I think primarily that's because we had a lot of feedback come in this week, so I think we're going to do a double round of feedback. Matt, I've got you up first, mainly because yours intros the aspect that we're talking about 10 out of 10 seasons.
Yeah, no worries at all. So this is from our very frequent emailer, CJ in Nebraska. Hello again, CJ. And he says, hey, CJ. Hey all, I hope everyone is well. Last episode, you discussed what TV seasons are a 10 out of 10. And I was thinking about it, and similar to you all the best seasons of TV I could think of were dramas. There are lots of great comedy TV shows that I love, but I'm not sure I would say any of them have a 10 out of 10 season. Maybe season 2 of Arrested Development, but I haven't watched it in a long time, and my perspective on it may have changed. Do you think that it's harder for a comedy series to be consistently great, or do you think there is a shared cultural bias against comedy TV shows when considering them in terms of acclaim? Or is there just something about drama that has a greater staying power and emotional resonance when compared to comedy that justifiably elevates it above comedy in terms of authentic art? Also, the best shape of donuts is the traditional donut shape. I think it's the perfect ratio of dough to topping. Also, I personally don't like donuts with filling, so just a good old-fashioned glazed donut is perfect for me. Love the show, and thank you for all the hours of joyful content you provide. Respect the sea.
The comedy thing, I 100% think comedy show, if anything, for me, I think it's easier for a comedy show to be a 10 out of 10 for me than a drama show, because I think comedy is so subjective, right? That if it to you personally, if it just triggers you and you're like, plugs directly into your funny bone, it's like, what is this show looking to deliver? What is this episode looking to deliver? If that has kept me like hilariously laughing all the way through, that's a 10 out of 10. 10 doesn't mean perfect, does it? It just means it's the best it can be for you. I think there's several early seasons of The Simpsons that are 10 out of 10. I think there's a couple of seasons of The Office, in fact, the UK Office, and some seasons of The US Office are, like, you know, just perfect, where I know I can put that season on, just watch it back to back.
Yeah.
I think even like season 5, I think, of Always Sunny in Philadelphia, for example, it's just like, every episode is consistently great.
I mean, that show's been running since like 2005, and it's, you know, had a lot of steam behind it, trying to keep those laughs up. And there's some episodes which aren't so fantastic.
It's very hit and miss these days, but there is some long running shows tend to have, you know, their peak seasons, right?
For sure.
But yeah, like 10 out of 10 out of 10 TV is hard, especially for drama, I think, because for drama, you're reliant on the through line narrative, right? Mm-hmm. You need it from the A to B needs to be consistently great and no dips. And even shows, I think, you know, like I think Breaking Bad is one of the greatest shows of all time. It has the odd episode where it might just lull just ever mm-hmm. so slightly. Whereas comedy, I feel like I'm judging the season on the merits of how good was each individual episode,
sure.
as opposed to the consistent through line. I'm not, mm-hmm. it's a different criteria
see,
that I'd be doing.
See, I almost have the same feeling as you, but with the opposite like outcome, in that it's kind of like, for me, like you will get seasons of comedy where there's just an episode where I don't laugh. And yeah. it's like, and because each episode has to stand on its own merit, because most comedies don't have a through line, right? So you can't be kept afloat by your investment in the characters and their ongoing kind of story.
Yeah.
It has to be based on if the gags are good. And if you yeah. just get one episode where the gags aren't good, then suddenly you don't have a 10 out of 10 season.
Sure. I get that. But it feels like more subjective than a drama story.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Like,
mm-hmm. So I guess that, you know, it's a personal respect. That's why, you know, like, yeah, I'd feel uncomfortable about reviewing a comedy series and the scoring at 10, because it's like, what I think is absolutely hilarious, even someone as close to me as my wife might think is just not funny at all, you know, yeah. like, and that happens a lot in my house. but you know, like, what is scoring a 10 anyway? You know, it's just like, you're telling people that you think something is great. You know,
yeah.
or a masterpiece in this mm-hmm. occasion. Yeah. Right, so personal opinions. And the donut thing. I don't have any strong feelings on donuts. I feel like this has become a topic of
donut discussion.
So
again?
I think me and Callie were talking about it, to be fair, but I think we didn't get any. We solicited feedback and we didn't get any. And then Callie made a point and we didn't get any, so now we've had loads coming in. But yeah, well, strong feelings on donuts, boys?
I love Crosstown Donuts, which is, I think they're mostly only in London, okay. but they're my favourite donuts. They're very expensive, but they are very tasteful. They're not. There's another company that I don't like that I see around London called Donut Time. I had a box of theirs, yes. and it just felt like they just stuck a load of fucking sweets on the top of them, yeah. way too much. Whereas for me, the Crosstown Donuts are tastefully done.
Yeah, I think Donut Time is the one in my town. They've got a little one of them. But it's everyone, I see them and I think, oh, that looks delicious. But I also think that looks like 4,000 calories.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if I'm going to get these ones, it's a rare treat. And I cut it in half and I have someone else has another half of it, because I just couldn't eat that much.
I think I prefer Cronuts than donuts, but it's not really a particularly strong opinion.
Is a Cronut a croissant donut?
Let us see.
Yeah. yeah, it's just a little donut, somewhat similar to a croissant, so a cronut. Okay. But yeah.
Okay, he's a cronut boy. right, I've got the next piece of feedback from Clark Baldwin, and Clark is also chiming in on the TV show thing, the 10 out of 10 TV show. And he says, it has to be Lost for me. Through its wild twists and solid zeitgeist conversation, it was a joy to be a part of that mystery as it unfolded. Yes, the writer's strike wrecked a bit of it and the ending was a disappointment, but overall it's one of the pinnacle shows on TV and has yet to be matched. Michael Giacchino's banger score was top tier too. Help that we had Heroes at the same time, which was also had an amazing first season. Mm. Respect the sea, Clark B. Ooh, little rhyme at the end.
I like
Lost is like one of my favorite shows of all time. I'm a huge fan, but even I can acknowledge that, you know, there is consistency issues. There is definitely, I think the first season is probably as close as it comes to in getting a perfect season of television.
Yeah.
But it also had to deal with the fact that they had to be 24 episode seasons back mm-hmm. then as well, which is like, it's almost an impossible task to maintain like this high bar.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's right in terms of zeitgeist conversation, and like it was what any nerd worth their salt back then watched Lost and talked about Lost yeah. every week. Mm. But I don't know if that necessarily makes it, you know, the show a masterpiece. It's more just like triggered something. It got into the, you know, the zeitgeist. And the writer, I would say, where he said mention the writer's strike, that was for season 4, and I think that's my favorite season because it's only 14 episodes and
just
it's
a little bit more focused.
Yeah, it's focused and tight. Yeah, and the ending is a different conversation. But
well, yes, I will say that this what Clark brings up that is interesting is, I do quite often think that the difference between a 9 and a 10 is the emotional value that the thing brings, right. And kind of like, I think, you know, if we, you know, I'm guessing, Dale, you wouldn't even necessarily give it an 8 for the entirety of its run. If you've got, for the entirety of its run. No, but yeah. It might be that it's a 9 that, because of his lived experience through like that time when it was such a thing, that emotion can help tick it over into the 10, right? Like, it's the thing that makes it special.
I'd say, without a doubt, there's a dozen episodes in Lost that are 10 out of 10 episodes. But consistently, as a show, an 8 would probably be all right. Because for every 10, there's a handful of, like, 4s as well. So, it kind of balances out.
I'm planning on watching it soon. I'm excited based on everything you've said, Dale.
Mate, just, like, there's a couple of episodes in Season 3, one called Stranger in a Strange Land in particular, which are just shockingly shit. And you can you can really tell at that point that they were treading water, trying to sign an agreement to end the show, because they were just, like, coming... It's an episode about how Jack got his tattoos, and it's just really rubbish.
I think I just remember, as a kid, because I think, like, my mum was maybe watching through Lost a bit when it was airing, and I just remember all the jokes about how it's just the most complex and bizarre show, and like everything's like a dream or it isn't, and no one knows what's going on, and
there's no dreaming. I don't know what you're on about there.
I just remember being
you're reading into that bullshit stupid narrative that people like thought at the end of the show it was a dream all along.
That's what I remember people always just bringing up about Lost. So it's going to be interesting to actually watch it, because I don't know anything about it.
You should totally watch it, Matt. And the fact that, like, if you don't know any major plot twists and spoilers, then you're getting a fresh view. Like, the only thing you're not getting is the week-to-week waiting right? And the conversations in between, which was, for me, that was a key part of the show. You know, it was being on forums, listening to podcasts every week, hearing, like, theories and everyone's predictions and theories and all sorts.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned it before, but my first experience of Lost was the Xbox 360 game. I think it was Lost via Domus or some shit.
Via Domus, yeah.
That was fucking awful.
Yeah, but it's also mad, because that is proper connected to the story as well.
Oh, no.
Although it's weird, because some of it's canon and some of it's not. So it's not really like connected.
So some is a dream and some isn't.
There's no dreaming. It was supposed to be canon when it came out. And I think as the show carried on, it kind of like some things were ruined.
Sad.
Yeah, you don't need to play that game. It's fine.
Good.
Jesse, you've got the next one.
Yes, it's Sandy from York. Hi all, Duck Hunt. Firstly, donuts. Dough Baker House in York sell my favorite donuts, basically like a fresher, tastier Krispy Kreme. Currently, I have a pistachio donut and a cream egg donut sat at home for me. Would recommend. Check it out, Northerners.
Cream egg donut doesn't sound right.
I do like a cream egg, but I'm not sure. It sounds like it'll be too rich in a donut for me.
This is my, like, I don't like it when people just throw, like, a chocolate bar into a donut. It's like, come up with an interesting flavor, like make a nice jam or a custard for it, put a good glaze on it.
I think I'm with you. They do look nice though, don't they? When they've got sweets
beautiful.
All over the top.
Yeah, they look amazing, but I don't think that, like, just go and buy a chocolate bar and then get a good donut.
Especially when you're taking a bite of it and all the things are just falling off the top.
Yeah. What I don't like is when people put sweets on donuts, like chewy candy sweets and stuff.
Fuck you.
I don't like, fuck you.
I love sweets, mate. Put them on everything. It's fine.
Oh, it just doesn't make sense to me. Anyway, Sandy goes on to say, secondly, 10 out of 10 TV season is Heroes Season 1. It's not perfect, but it's a masterpiece of superhero TV show. Its characters feel well-rounded and are engaging. Great mix of storytelling and mystery. Excellent villain and genuinely creepy. Miles above every other superhero TV show. So sad they basically ruined it from season 2 onwards. But for just that one season, outstanding. Extra feedback. Never agreed with Joe's reviews, but thought he was top bloke and miss him on the pod. Respect Joe's review. That's great. That's a fantastic way to end that.
You didn't finish up. What was the last little piece?
My bad. Respect the sea. Gravediggers and poppadoms are the best savoury snack. Sandy from York.
I think I actually agree with that Poppadom statement, to be fair. I really want to know what reviews of Joe's they really disagreed with. But Heroes, I never watched Heroes.
I'm surprised to keep hearing that it seems to be like an amazing first season. And then, because I've seen like the occasional YouTube retrospective thumbnail where it's like, what went wrong with Heroes
There's
and stuff.
There's a few shows around a few shows of that era where there was like that, right? Prison Break was like that as well, wasn't it? Like, had a really good first season and then sort of dropped off.
And then he gets out of the prison.
Dexter, I believe, was like that too. Never really
Dexter was good for like four seasons.
Oh, okay.
Five is... I quite like five, but it's not it's not brilliant. As for Heroes, my season one came out in the summer just before I went to uni, and season two started just as I got to uni. And like my bedroom wall in my first place at uni had got like a giant sort of like Heroes ensemble poster and a big poster of Hayden Panettiere from Heroes.
That's what sort of like... That was her first big role, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, the whole Save the Cheerleader, Save the World stuff from Heroes is genuinely very good. And the man in the horn-rimmed glasses as a kind of villain is genuinely a very good like continuation of the smoking man kind of trope from The X-Files. The whole... I wouldn't necessarily say it was a 10 out of 10. And I don't know if it's... Is it? Do I think it's the best superhero TV show? It's a very good like reinterpretation before the MCU came and... completely redefined what we thought of superheroes and comic books. It was a good... I liked it because it wasn't adapting something straight. It was honoring like the traditions of the genre and like reinventing them and doing fun things. It's 24 episodes long, which means I'll never ever revisit it because I don't have the patience for long TV shows anymore. But I've got fond memories of that first season. I genuinely think it was very groundbreaking at the time.
I haven't seen it, but also want to say that the best TV superhero show is The Boys, not Heroes.
That's true. Yeah, no, The Boys is better.
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of any Marvel ones I really loved, to be honest. No, like, they're all like, I suppose the first couple of seasons of Daredevil were like quite revered. Yeah, people loved them. I was never massive in it.
Yeah, I really like the first season of Jessica Jones as well. But like in terms of, I think The Boys does exactly what it sets out to do and it does it damn fucking well.
Yeah.
It's the best. Matt, you're up next.
Yeah, so this is from Elliot in Melbourne. And he says, "Hi, IGN UK folks. For a while, I lived in China as a teacher. In a bid to avoid working when hungover, I decided to show a few Western movies throughout my time there. To keep it equal, I showed each movie to all of my classes. As a result, I saw Shaun of the Dead, Mean Girls, and Pet Sematary about 20 times each in the space of a week. It took about 10 years before I could watch any of them again. Respect the sea from Elliot."
This is in response to last week when, what did somebody say they watched? Like, oh, they watched, was it Midsommar? Like five nights in a row.
That's way too many. What?
Yeah. And it's like, and then the question was posed, have you ever watched a film like repeatedly, like when it first came out? And then, yeah, this happened.
I think for me, that was 2012's Battleship. I saw it four times in the space of a week. Different friends wanted to go and they just kept paying for my tickets and just took me out to dinner. So I was like, might as well.
Hang on. But like, that's a dog shit film though, right?
Yeah, it's dreadful, but...
But why? Just... But if they're paying for your ticket, I'll be like, you have to pay me to go. Not pay me for the ticket, pay me extra money if it's bad.
They got me food afterwards, so it was fine.
Prostituting yourself for Battleship.
For Battleship, yeah. Great time, 2012.
I saw A Force Awakens five times at the cinema, to be fair. It wasn't back to back. It was like... over the course of a month, you know. And it was also like a couple of times, you know, I went with three different people to see it. And then a couple of times just because I was obsessed and I wanted to watch it again, you know.
Star Wars nerd.
Yeah. Oh, mate, it was the best time. It was the best time to be a Star Wars fan when The Force Awakens came out.
Yeah,
it was
so good.
What about you guys then? Apart from Battleships, Matt, have you got any films that you've watched back to back?
No. I mean, it takes me years. I think there's been a couple of times when there's been things at the cinema that I've watched, but it's always been like about 3 weeks later coming to the end of the run. So like I saw Blade Runner 2049 when it first came out, and then I watched it just as it was coming to the end of the run.
Yeah.
But no. Like most of the time I need like at least 5 years before I go back and see something.
Didn't you have any like uni films or anything like that? Like when you live with friends or anything?
No.
Like, I've got a few films like that, which we wouldn't watch back to back, but we'd definitely watch like a few times a month because it was just like, we're hanging out, we'll put it on.
Right.
And then we're like, Will Ferrell's Old School was one of them. The Starsky and Hutch. It was very much that era.
The Starsky and Hutch film.
Yeah. I watched that loads. The Anchorman. I think Matt mentioned on the podcast last week, but Basketball, that was one that was definitely in rotation as well. It was that kind of era of comedy film, really, that would... there was Friday as well. I used to watch that quite a lot too. But it's good times. Good times. I know all those films. Like, I know the entire script. Like, burned into my brain. By the way, write into IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com if you've got any films that you've watched religiously over a very short span of time, or if you want to talk about donuts, go for it. You know,
how many times have you seen Battleship in the cinema? Let us know.
That's mad. And you justified, like, it was such a, like, an impressive thing, as in, like, I wouldn't get free food for it.
I mean, that was the only benefit. The same sort of happened with Transformers Dark Side of the Moon, or Dark of the Moon. That was also shit. Yeah. But, yeah, free food afterwards, so I can't complain.
Those ones are, like, 2.5 hours, 3 hours long as well, aren't they? The Transformers. Yeah. Yeah. Sadist, out, mate. right, I got the next one from Gage Luke. Wait, is that Luke? I read that as Luke Cage for a second. He says, I appreciate this, Gage, because I, the other week, said that I wanted to call emails vibe checks from now on. And he is the only person who's written in calling him a vibe check. Vibe? What's the vibe? He says, how's your vibe? Can I get a vibe check? You can get a vibe check, mate. All right, here's the thing. What the fuck are Weetabix? As a traitorous Yankee, I've no knowledge of this strange breakfast creation from the Commonwealth. I realise I could just Google what they are, but after listening to you talk so much about them on the Vibecast, appreciate that as well, I thought it would be more fun for me to just describe what I think they are based on your chat, and then have you all tell me how right or wrong I am. So this is Gage's Luke. Fucking hell, mate.
You're now Gage. Luke Cage.
His name is Gage, not Luke Cage. Luke Cage's opinion of what Weetabix are. Weetabix. I don't know if I'm spelling that right. He's not spelling that right. Yes. I think. What is it? There's no H, right?
So no H.
W-E. Yeah. Are small granola bars that you break up into a bowl and pour milk or water over. The water aspect makes me think that it's closer to oatmeal or grits, because pouring water over cereal sounds like the most bland experience I've ever imagined putting in my mouth. The fact that you can eat them hot makes me think it's definitely more of an oatmeal, but the fact that one guy was eating 20 a day makes me think that this is more like a bite-sized cookie type thing. Are these bland wheat cookies that you put hot milk over and eat like breakfast cereal? What the fuck is going on here? Love you all, respect the sea, but gravediggers are untrustworthy and you should be wary of them.
Okay.
Where do we start?
So I think the first thing to establish here is that cereals in the US are very different to cereals in the UK. Yeah. Having very recently been in a Target or walked down the cereals aisle trying to find some low-sugar breakfast cereal, let me tell you, you can't fucking do that in America, because American cereals are all candy.
Unless it's granola or something. Yeah, and it's like the opposite end of the spectrum.
Oh, even that has got so much sugar in it, because they use sugar to stick the oat clusters together, right? So... Yeah. Whereas in the UK, we have, I guess, what you would consider compared to fruit pebbles and all of that, somewhat blander cereal. So I guess small granola bars is at least within the vague ballpark, right, of what it is. It's a, I guess, like palm-sized, like, brick made up of wheat that has kind of like been compressed together, I suppose, is the best way.
Palm size is a good, they're definitely like palm size. They've got with like a brick, but with radiused edges.
Yeah.
And it's all very like heavily compressed. But as soon as you pour milk on it, the thing kind of like goes soggy and falls apart a little bit. And then you mash it up and turn it
into like a porridge consistency, or as you say, an oatmeal consistency.
Yeah. Do want to point out the person eating 20 a day. I thought that he was talking about the Australian Weetabix ones, which are like mini ones.
They're smaller, yeah.
There's no way a human being can eat 20 British Weetabix a day.
No.
Like, it's impossible. Yeah. You'd have to, like, the size of the bowl alone would have to be insane.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, some people do have them hot. I don't think that's particularly, like, that common. Like, everyone I've known never eats them hot, but it's mostly and also the water thing is weird, so it's mostly just milk, and then people tend to put a bit of sugar on top of them because there is no sugar. It's just pure wheat.
And I guess some people will then throw some like blueberries or like cut a banana on top of it and stuff like that to give you a little bit of extra. But yeah, the 20 a day, like, I know that the Australian ones are smaller. I don't think they're like, I think they're only about half the size of a UK one.
And it's like mini 10 ones though, can't you?
You can get mini Weetabix, which are, as he says, a bite-sized cookie type thing. That is closer to what a mini Weetabix is, because they either have chocolate chips in or little bits of raisin. True.
Those are the best ones.
But yeah, the idea of eating 20 a day, I still think sounds mad, even if they're smaller. Because Weetabix is quite a filling breakfast cereal compared to a lot of other options. Like, it's kind of thick when you eat it if you've broken it down into, like, sludge.
It's quite a unique cereal as well, because I feel like it's not... Nobody's just eating Weetabix, right, on their own. It's one that you have to add things to. Like, even, like, at the, yeah, like I said, the pure base level is milk and a bit of sugar, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then there's all these other things that you add on top of it. It's not just, like, cornflakes or something. It's just, like, out of the box. You can just eat it, you know.
I mean, you can. And they do the banana-flavoured one, don't they? And they do the chocolate-flavoured one. But,
oh,
like,
I've never bought them.
They so don't taste good to me.
I'm a traditional boy when it comes to Weetabix.
It's definitely the base of your breakfast, isn't it, rather than the breakfast itself.
Yeah, you build on top of it. Yeah.
The Weetabix lore.
I do like Weetabix. I do remember the day when I moved from 2 to 3 Weetabix. That was when I knew I became a man.
Look at you now, Dale.
Still on 3, to be fair. Although I haven't had them in such a long time. I'm on Rice Krispies at the moment. Mm. I rotate my cereal between Rice Krispies, cornflakes, Shreddies and Weetabix.
I think Weetabix tastes just grim. Just tastes like dirt to me for some reason.
Get some stuff on them, mate.
I've just been eating them with water. I think that's my issue.
With water, Jesse?
I'm fucking joking.
Yeah, you need to add stuff. It's like sugar is an absolute must on Weetabix, you know. Yeah. We've got one last email, Jesse. This is up for you.
Yeah, this is from Tom Crump.
Why did you do that?
It sounds like a powerful name.
Does it? Tom Crump?
It sounds like a villain name. Like in
Sounds
Harry
like
Potter.
A bloody Tolkien character. Yeah.
Tom Crump says, "Hello, IGN goblins.
I don't regret calling him a Tolkien character now. Yeah.
Hope this first quarter of the year has been all right for you. Speaking on donuts, which seemingly no one has piped up on, the cowards. Wow. The best donuts are the freshly fried donuts in those huge humming trucks that for some reason are always parked up our local Asda in Leicester." I wouldn't be able to relate to that, mate.
Know what he means, where the big, like, just the random vans you see at festivals and they've got these donuts that are just like...
I've just never seen a...
Disgustingly sugary.
I've never seen just the donut van before.
Really?
Oh,
I've
seen like a van that sells, you know, a variety of things, but never just a specific donut van.
Oh, they exist.
Yeah.
That seems foreign to me. You people in the Midlands.
I mean, it is true. There used to be one in the Wolverhampton High Street every Saturday.
Maybe it is a Midlands thing, but the big old dirty fry. I remember, like, I think he mentions car boot sales, but I remember when I used to go to car boot sales with my dad and they'd always have that van, always.
That's weird. It's like a fucking stalker. Anyway, Crump goes on to say they are sublime. The smell carried throughout the entire car park, large. And sugar donuts are just better. They just are. And I do make the rules.
Oh, bloody hell.
Occasionally,
there's a lot of attitude in this era.
Yeah, no, I like Tom Crump. It's good stuff. Occasionally when a car boot fair is visited, there is no highlight that of seeing a used yoga mat, a pile of clothes on a piece of tarp, and 3 copies of Trainspotting on VHS, all blue from sun damage. They crop up there too, filling the insatiable need for hot sugar at 7:04 in the morning on a Sunday. God's day. It's what he did on the seventh day. Boot fair and donuts, nutter.
Yeah.
Also, if one of the horror boys is on, please speak on Mundawn. It's one of the best games I've ever played, completely hand-drawn and scanned on 3D textures. Basically, Swiss the Wicker Man. Love you, sesh heads. Respect the sea. Also, my name is Tom Crump, so the sea is me. You have all been respecting me the whole time. Brilliant. Thank you, Tom Crump. I will go ahead and disappoint you. I played a bit of Mundawn. Thought it was boring. Stopped playing it. Wouldn't say it's one of the best games, but it is visually quite impressive.
Turns out Jesse does not respect the sea on this occasion.
I am no longer a fan of the Crump.
I don't even know what that game is. So, but if you don't like it, Jesse, I imagine I'm probably not worth my time checking out.
Nah. Don't do it. Don't listen to Crump.
Even though the Crump star is big on it. It's selling it.
That sounds like a donut, to be fair.
The Crumpster.
Well, yeah, just like a crump.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what that would be, though. Don't know what that would look like.
Yeah. Donuts, hey. People are writing in about... We had quite a few on donuts this week, as well as the 10 out of 10 TV shows. Keep sending in your thoughts at IGN_UKFeedback@IGN.com. And that's us for the week, I think, guys.
Yeah, just make sure to catch a viewing of a battleship and have a good weekend, everyone.
I would generally like... I want to hear from other people who have seen Battleship more than once. There must be out there.
I can't remember a single thing from Battleship, to be fair. So.
Isn't Rihanna in it?
Yeah, she is. Yeah. But she's not in the game. Unbelievable.
I love that. Wait, what game are you talking about here?
The like Battleship the actual, game.
The traditional board game.
No, the first-person shooter they made on the Xbox 360 and PS3.
Why did you like you play? First, you talk about Los Villadomas, and now you're talking about why did you play these bad games?
They were like £2 at the store. Might as well pick them up, innit?
Yeah, might as well. Yeah,
it's time to finish.
I'm gonna go eat a crumb.
Right, see you later.
Bye.
Bye.